Upton Bell joins us on Sports Byline. I haven't talked to him for more than 40 years, and I'll explain my relationship with him in just a moment, but he's a former NFL executive, currently a talk show host and commentator. He is the son of former NFL commissioner Burt Bell, and his mother is Broadway actress Frances Upton, and he has written an insightful and interesting book about his life and his career. It's called Present at the Creation, My Life in the NFL and the Rise of America's Game. Upton, good to talk to you again. It's been too long.
It is great to talk to you, and we certainly had a lot of fun here in Boston. And I will tell you, by the way, starting off the interview, that I had no intention of writing anything until Ernie Accorsi, who you know was the New York Giants general manager, and he and I started off in Baltimore at the Colts together years ago. I would tell him all of these stories, and he said, "These are unbelievable. You ought to get them down." I said, I'm not sure. I've had a very exciting life. I don't know whether I want to follow that routine." He said, "You should." And so I looked for somebody like, let's say, you with your experience in the business, but somebody, Ron, that could go back actually to 1946, the Monsters of the Midway, and understand that era, America, how it changed to today. And that's why I chose Ron Borges, who had his foot enough in the past and then, of course, still around today. Because if you don't have somebody like that, it's like, you know, during your show, if you don't have the experience to talk about things that went way back and then compare them to today, might as well not do it.
I want to tell people this is a very well-written book, and it's also, when you get a sports book that's 379 pages, that should tell you something about the information and the great stories that are in it. And again, it's called Present at the Creation. Let's start, though, Upton, by going back to growing up in a family with a dad who was an influential NFL commissioner and a mother who was a Broadway star. What was that like?
It was a movie from beginning to end. And the reason I say that is I actually was almost born in a hotel and lived for the first 4 or 5 years in a hotel that was owned by my grandfather, the Ritz-Carlton in Philadelphia. And my father at the time, his father was one of the wealthiest people in Pennsylvania. He was Attorney General of Pennsylvania. And when asked about his son, Burt Bell, he said, "Where's Burt Bell?" Or the press asked him, "Where's Burt Bell going to go to college?" And he said, "He's either going to Penn or he's going to hell." And that was the headline. And interesting, because again, given the time that we have, try and tell people about this book and about the experiences. I would say somebody who read the book said, and this is not me, Ron, they said, "It's a movie. Those characters from the past, the whole idea." I lived in a hotel and then five different houses. I thought we had all sorts of money, and then I found out later we kept moving from house to house because, A, nobody wanted 33 players in the same house on the main line of Philadelphia. And so every time either the payroll needed to be met or something like that, we moved to another house. So it was an incredible experience. Because Burt Bell actually was broke. And when he bought that team out of bankruptcy, he was walking. My mother had lent him the money because his father, who was very wealthy, cut him off and said, "Burt, you've lost almost $1 million. I mean, this is the end of it." So my mother actually got him interested in pro football. She said, "All you do is spend your time in college football." He became a coach after finishing at Penn. And by the way, this is the 100th anniversary of Burt Bell throwing the first forward pass in Rose Bowl history. And all of the things that happened around this are just an amazing story. My mother was a Ziegfeld Follies star, named one of the most beautiful women in America, and basically was discovered by one of the Schubert's talent scouts as she was working after school at the perfume counter at Macy's. And he walked by and said, "God, you're beautiful." He said, what are you doing?" She said, "Well, I'm in high school and I do take different classes in dance." And he said, "Well, if you're ever interested, you know, maybe we can do something." 4 years later, she was a star on Broadway at the age of 20, 21. That her part, and I know I'm jumping around somewhat, is amazing because this is a woman whose father spoke seven languages, never finished high school, got on a boat, came across from Ireland, and the New York police force hired him because he could speak enough languages that they could send him into, let's say, the Italian section and look for the black hand criminals over the German section, all different areas. So her side of the family is an incredible story. But I want to make the point this that I try to in the book with Ron Borges, and that is basically, I know it's hard to believe, if Frances Upton doesn't tell Burt Bell to stop the drinking, spending the money, and says, basically, if you stop that, I would think about marrying you. Now, at that time, she was engaged to Bernard Baruch's son, the famous Wolf of Wall Street, mm-hmm. in the Roosevelt administration. She broke that engagement, and somebody said, why would you marry a bum like Burt Bell? And she said, I just had a feeling about him that he would kind of straighten his life out. Well, of course he did, but if she doesn't come along, I know this is kind of a boast, I don't think there's any National Football League, and I'll tell you why. Because when they finally got married, the honeymoon was in Atlantic City with 33 football players, and they sat on the porch while he worked out the team on the front lawn. That was the honeymoon. And from there, I mean, it just grew to the point of, if Burt Bell doesn't invent the pro football draft, there is no NFL. The league was going broke. Teams were going out of business. There were only eight teams then, and he proposed at a league meeting. He said, we're only as strong as our weakest link. And he said, myself with the Eagles and the Steelers, and we could not make it. The Redskins could go out and sign anybody they wanted to. The Bears could. They had all the money, the New York Giants. So he convinced those owners to turn around and have a draft, which would penalize them. And the first one was in 1936. I think it saved pro football, and then every sport adopted it. If there's no NFL draft, there's no NFL you see today.
Who were the early influences football-wise on Upton Bell?
I would say certainly my father, but the first training camp that I went to in 1946 at the age of nine, I was a little precocious, and sitting on a tackling dummy and walking out before, even then, people think today, boy, they're huge crowds. There would be 10,000 people at St. Joseph's College in Rensselaer, Indiana, and George Halas walked out, this magnificent figure of the monsters in the Midway, and said, essentially, I can't use the language on the air, like Bill Belichick. Last year doesn't mean a GD thing, and he went on this really incredible rant and talking about the players and what they need to do. But there also was kind of the modern cradle of pro football, because Clark Shaughnessy, who really separated the back from the backfield and put them out and invented the flanker, actually brought the modern pro game, the passing game, to pro football. And I was able to sit in there, and Halas let myself and my brother sit in these meetings. Even at 9 years old, they let us sit in and watch Clark Shaughnessy actually draw up the first invention of the flanker and the passing game. It that was an amazing time. And at that time, Sid Luckman, Hall of Famer, was the quarterback. George McAfee, Hall of Famer, who later became an official in the NFL. Bill Osmanski, you know, they had all of those great players. Now, here's the interesting thing, jumping around a couple of years. Only time in history. Here were the four quarterbacks. Luckman, the starter. Behind him, Johnny Lujack, who later succeeded him. Behind him, Bobby Lane, Hall of Famer. Behind him, George Blanda. They got rid of everybody, and they only kept Blanda because in those days, 33 players, Halas said, hey, we can afford him, he can kick. So that was the early influence in my life of watching players. And I also want to try to tell your audience, this captures an era where, and I'm not saying they're better players, I'm not saying it was better then, all I'm saying was it was, for instance, at the All-Star game, in Chicago. 80, 90,000 people. No TV. It was these huge crowds, and you would hear this roar when the All-Stars would run out. And whether it was the Bears or the Rams playing later on, it was an amazing thing to see. The same way on the West Coast, the first time that the Rams moved from Cleveland out to L.A., and you would see huge crowds at the Coliseum. And remember, as I talked about in the book, that broke the color line back in the NFL. And it was my father's first year.
Hold on just a second, Upton. I got to take a break here. Upton Bell is with us, former NFL executive, also currently a talk show host. But I want you to check out this book because we're going to make it a selection of the month on the Sports Byline Book Corner, Present at the Creation, My Life in the NFL and the Rise of America's Game. We continue across the country and around the world. We've got you on Sports Byline. Upton Bell is with us, and we're talking about his book, Present at the Creation, My Life in the NFL, The Rise of America's Game. His father was the NFL commissioner, Burt Bell. His mother, a Broadway actress, Frances Upton, and he also was a former NFL executive. He, at a very young age, was the general manager of the New England Patriots. It wasn't called the New England Patriots at that time. But Upton, you started your football career by working at the Baltimore Colts training camp and eventually becoming the personnel director, as you mentioned. You worked with Weeb Eubank and Don Shula. Talk to me about each one.
One was a little college professor. The other one was as dominating as Vince Lombardi or anybody today. I spent 3 years with Weeb. And I want to say this, and I pick later on in the book the greatest coaches and quarterbacks of all time. One of the most underrated coaches was Weeb Eubank. He won, Ron, the two most important games in NFL history. He won the 1958 sudden death game that changed the history of pro football on television and had people then have a takeover essentially from baseball. Then he came back 10 years later, after Rosenblum had fired him at the Colts and beat us in the biggest upset of all time in the 68 game that Joe Namath predicted the victory. He was one of those people that you would kind of ignore until you listen to him and you watch him. One of the greatest speeches ever made in the locker room before a game, and Weeb wasn't a big speech guy, is in the 58 game, he went around the locker room before the game and he said, "Gino Marchetti, you fought the Battle of the Bulge, but nobody wanted you as a player. Art Donovan, we picked you off of nowhere. Lenny Moore, you might have made it here. John Unitas, you were a $7 a week a player at the Bloomfield Rams." He went around, "Big Daddy Lipscomb, we found you on a military base. All of you, this is the biggest game of your life. And remember, you're playing so people will forget the past and remember you today." What a speech. So I really believe that he is one of the most underrated. Shula, I think, is, and I'll give you this reason why. I know it's all Belichick now, and certainly he's a great coach. But Shula embodied the parts of Lombardi, but he also embodied the other part. He's the only coach that I really knew that played and won with every type of quarterback and running back. He had Unitas near the end of his career. He and Unitas didn't essentially get along, but he had him. And when Unitas went down, he went to Earl Morrow, and Earl Morrow carried us all the way to the Super Bowl. We did not win it, but he did. Then in one of the great games that we actually lost because the officials missed the good field goal, is we lost all our quarterbacks, and Tom Matte, with a little tape around his arm with the plays on it, almost led us to one of the biggest upsets of all time in 65 against Green Bay. He then left. Went to Miami, completely scrapped it, and took Zonka Kick and Warfield and put in a running game with Bob Greasy and then Paul Warfield. And then again, he turned around after losing them and turned around to a quarterback, David Woodley, took him to the Super Bowl. Nobody ever heard of Woodley again. But then again, he made another move, bringing in Marino and winning that way. He's won every which way, has the greatest record of all time. His Super Bowl record is not good, but remember, the Patriots could either be 0-7 or 7-0. It's one game, and to judge any coach on one game is absolutely ridiculous. So that's my quick look at them.
What was the commonality that both these successful coaches had, Weeb Eubank and Don Shula?
The understanding. I mean, forget the technical part of it. The reason that football is the most difficult sport to coach is it's so intricate, and even more so today. But if you don't know your players, because unlike a basketball team, baseball team, hockey team, football, you're talking about 22 players. So you have to understand all those personalities. And when we, for instance, took over, Big Daddy Lipscomb could be a real problem, a great player. Geno was kind of the quiet leader of it. Unitas was somebody that was so unique. Maybe I've never seen anybody as unique as he was. All of these huge egos, and you've got to learn how to deal with them, control them. Some, like Lombardi and Shula, kind of impose their will upon the player. In the case of Weeb, he's the college professor that's going to convince you that this is the right thing. But if you cannot handle the personnel, and even more so today because personnel is much more rebellious today, then it was a little bit more they would kind of take the coaching. But if you don't have that, forget all the technical stuff. It's not going to work.
At 33, you become the NFL's youngest general manager. One of the first moves you recommended when you took over at New England was that they change the name from Bay State Patriots to the New England Patriots. But the question I have for you is, knowing Boston, because I was there at the same time you were, I was on WSMW television there, I'm just wondering, what were the Patriots like? Because that was not only a Celtics town, but it was a Bruins town as well.
Well, first and foremost, if your assistant general manager is working out of the men's room, you know you're in trouble. That's number one. Actually, this is literally true, Ron. When I walked in, I mean, I knew that it was not going to be great. And that's why you get an opportunity at a very young age, because the teams that are in trouble want to hire you. But when I expected a lot, but when I walked in and saw that literally the office was in the left field of Fenway Park, and if somebody hit a home run, sometimes the ball would come down through everything and end up right in my office. And I'm looking up and I'm saying, oh, God, did I really do this? And then when I hired people, there was no room, and eventually I hired Peter Hathaway in the league office. He literally had to work in the men's room. And so when I looked at the situation, I basically said, the first day I was here, the headline said, BS Patriots to move to Foxborough. And, of course, everybody hated Billy Sullivan, so that was either Billy Sullivan or even the worst thing. The columnists were making fun of it. They really are BS. So I immediately went to the board of directors and said, we've got to change this. We're moving to Foxborough. We're in the middle of a five-state area. Let's call it the New England Patriots. Now, here's what you kind of really love is you figure that, they say, okay, let's go ahead and do it. You know what they said? We have to put it to a vote of the board. Board of what? And they said, well, we have a big board here. I said, well, you know what? This is not a game or a business of boards. So that I had to deal with all the way through. But it was an amazing experience because, again, I was able to push through hiring Buck O'Kilroy from the Dallas Cowboys, Peter Hathaway from the legal office. Three or four different scouts went on to be head people. So I was able to get that done. But the one thing I was not able to do, and here is a great, I think, thing that people ought to pay attention in life, especially in the NFL. You're either an owner or a renter. If you don't own the team, you're a renter. And if you're a renter, you're subjected to what that owner, or in this case, board, wants. If they don't like you, you're gone.
I do know that you wanted to fire the head coach, John Mazur, and hire a coach of your own choosing. Didn't get the opportunity to do that the first time out. Did eventually get to do it. And you're going to have to help me with this story. I remember covering one of the Patriots games, and I forget who it was against, but you had a linebacker that came out of the University of Tennessee that used to live on a bus.
And Steve Kiner.
That's the person. And what I remember about him is that he was inactive for a ball game, and I guess you had an injury at the linebacking position, and I went out to get something to drink, and when I came back, he was gone, and I said, where is Steve? And they said, well, they paged him out of the stands. And the next thing I know, they name him on the PA system of making a tackle during the course of the second half.
Yes, you know what, that's a little different. I'm sorry, that was Bob Gladio, And that was the year before I came here. Actually, we were playing against them, and it was Cleve Rush who was the coach who eventually went crazy. And that's how I ended up here, because they fired everybody. But that is absolutely a true story that I saw. They called him Harpo years later.
Right.
He was sitting in the stands, and he was drinking because he was inactive that day. And
yes.
So Rush said, get that guy the hell out here. We need him. We need him now. I'm going to put this other person on waivers. And they go up and get him. And the next thing you know, his friends who continue to drink thought that they were having a nightmare or something. Look down, and there he is on the field making a tackle. But I will tell you quickly, because it happened in San Francisco, about Steve Kiner, another player that I had picked up, who could have been Rookie of the Year. I made a deal to get him from Dallas the same time as Dwayne Thomas. Anyway, there is a fascinating, and it might still, 49ers might still have it. We were playing out there in 1971, and the team had been doing very well. Anyway, Kiner was into drugs, as we found out later on.
Yeah, we have about 20 seconds, Upton, so go ahead.
Okay, so what happened was, on film, you see the play run, and everybody is moving, and Kiner's still in the same position, and he never moves for two plays. He's just frozen there. It's an amazing shot.
We're talking with Upton Bell, and there's more stories like this and also more information about the development of the National Football League. It's called Present at the Creation, My Life in the NFL and the Rise of America's Game. I recommend it. We continue with Sports Byline. Upton Bell is with us on Sports Byline USA. I've known Upton since I was in Boston, went to WSMW on television doing sports there and back in 1972. And, of course, Upton was very young when he took over as the general manager of the Patriots at that particular time. Just a reflection, because there's so many other things I want to get into with you. But as you think about the National Football League at that time, and like the story you told about Kiner and everything, what are the stories that really jump out to you that really says what the National Football League was like at that time, Upton?
Well, what really stands out to me is there were, at that time, great rivalries. I mean, there weren't 32 teams. And so you had, for instance, the Patriots and Buffalo. You know, both teams hated each other. You know, you had the Giants and the Philadelphia Eagles. You had a great rivalry, Al Davis in Oakland and Kansas City. That part really, I thought, was in some ways the golden era. Maybe not as proficient as some of the players today, but more sense of rivalry, more a sense of a different type of game. For instance, a Tom Brady, if he played then, could drink all of that green water that he drinks and all that diet, and he'd still be through at 32. The game was much rougher. The quarterback was not protected like they are today. The rules were different. They didn't penalize the defense the way they do today. You know, you really had to be good. Today, it's still a great game, but it's more like pinball. And so those type of things you saw. The other thing is that the quarterbacks then, now remember, there were less teams, but there were more good quarterbacks. And the other thing that you did not get away with that you do today, for instance, the Patriots, as good as they are, over 17 years, they win their division every year because there is nobody. Then you had somebody tough every week, and there were no easy games. Today, there are a lot of them.
You mentioned about Billy Sullivan and people not liking him, but tell me overall, how would you describe and what were some of your favorite stories about the owners in professional football at that time?
Well, there were more characters there. Than
right.
They were different. So starting with, let's say, Al Davis. I mean, it's a shame the way his life ended. A lot of people were making fun of him. But I would say Davis there should be a movie about him. He was suspicious of everybody and everything. One of those people you'd be having a conversation with, and still be looking around the corner to see who's maybe spying on him. But he was really brilliant. He really knew the game. He knew the proper coaches to hire. He could get all these outlaw type of players, including one player I drafted, Ted Hendricks, who first played out his option in Baltimore and then ended up at Oakland and, of course, into the Hall of Fame. But he had all these characters on the team. They were always fist fighting. There were always all of these crazy things going on. But when Sunday came, and the snake stabler lined up to go, whether they'd been drinking all night or not, they were a formidable team. He was a great character. Half the people hated him. The other half liked him. He was one. I also say the Maras were an interesting group, an O-line team. But Wellington Mara, again, who was forced to take over after his brother died, I would say, and I write this in the book in the epilogue, there was no more brilliant for his time than Wellington Mara. He was the scout. He was the general manager. He brought so many of those great Giant teams together, but he was a different type of person. I mean, Lamar Hunt, I remember my father met with him when he wanted to get in the NFL, and my father said to him, Lamar, let's wait for a while. And, of course, Hunt went on, and he didn't want to wait. He was 27 years old. I don't remember from the meetings where I sat in as a kid him ever saying a word. He was the shyest person, the richest person, but the shyest person I've ever been around. So they're just some of the characters. There were many more. I mean, there were fist fights in league meetings. None of this today. They call each other names today over $5 billion.
Well, the other thing, too, how was the Dallas Cowboys perceived and looked upon? Because that America's team was something that rankled a lot of other teams and a lot of other players.
Never bothered me. And in fact, one of the things that I wonder about, many of my contemporaries finally are going into the Hall of Fame that were scouts. And I would say that Tex Ram Gilbrandt and Tom Landry formed a troika that was unbelievable. A lot of people didn't like Brandt. They said, oh, he's a former baby photographer. But he started the league, and people copied him into the computer age and changed everything. And the same way with Landry with his doomsday defense. But I would say, and again, this is in the epilogue, a lot of things that I cover I can't in the other chapters in the book. Tex Ram, I would say, was really the commissioner in some ways, next to Pete Rozelle, just a brilliant tactician, very, very smart. But those three together, put together, in some ways, I think the modern NFL.
I know you returned to professional football after you left the Patriots in 1974 with the purchase of the New York Stars of the World Football League, and you relocated the team to Charlotte, North Carolina, where the team was then renamed the Charlotte Hornets. And that venture did not work out well because the World Football League then folded in 1975. Tell me a little bit about that experience.
Three really good stories, and they are the following. Arnold Palmer, Ted Turner, and somebody that I think was an undercover agent for the CIA. And then the final thing is, that the person that I thought was going to put $1 million into it ended up trying to commit suicide off the Verrazano Bridge, and they had a wire on him, and he eventually was found in the trunk of a car. So it that time was really something. So I convinced Arnold Palmer to put some money into the team because I wanted to buy it totally out from Bob Smertz, which I did. Two or three meetings with Palmer, one of the great people in American history as far as sports is concerned. He said two things. He said, I'll give you $10,000. I'll let you ride around in one of my gold Cadillacs, but I never want, when I come to the games, the cameras on me. Second one, Ted Turner. Ted Turner, you know, had that great network throughout the South that I was trying to fight the NFL. And so he had a local station, WRET, in Charlotte. And basically he came in one day, sat at the desk, feet up, no socks on, blazer on, and said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to take your team and I'm going to put it all over the South. And he said, we're going to take the NFL on. And so then he started to say, you know, I'm thinking about this network that I'm thinking about inventing. It'll be news 24 hours a day. And I stupidly said to him, never make it. That's the last time I saw Turner.
Well, the other thing, too, and you mentioned it a little bit earlier, there is so much information, so many stories, so many insights in this book that you had to do an epilogue. Explain to everybody what the epilogue is and what you were trying to do with that information.
Well, what I told Ron Borges, who wrote the other chapters, I'm going to put the things in that we could not get in that were somewhat historic, and I would take a look at a lot of different things. For instance, my father knew Al Capone, and when the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped, Capone was serving in the penitentiary in Philadelphia, federal penitentiary. So friends of my father said, can you get to Capone and find out whether the Lindbergh baby actually was a Bruno Hauptmann or was the mafia actually took the baby and killed it. Within 24 hours, he got to Capone, and Capone told him, let me see what I can find out. Capone never left the cell and found out. He got back to my father and said, it's not an underworld job. The famous Dempsey Tunney fight, my father found out about it at the fight in Chicago and convinced people to bring it to Philadelphia. One of the other ones is very, very funny. He was a great friend of John B. Kelly, Grace Kelly's father. They went to the First World War together and became friends, and he had tried to push Kelly to be the commissioner of the NFL at one time back in the 30s. But one day I'm sitting there, and Kelly calls my father, and he said, you know, Bert, he said, Gracie's in this GD movie, isn't going to do a damn thing. He said, it's just one of these low-budget Westerns. And my father said, what's that? He said, well, it's this Western called High Noon with Gary Cooper. I'll leave it with one more. A lot of things that I learned about race are in chapter, I think it's 14, called The South is Burning, and it stayed with me the rest of my life, including today, what we see, what's going on. But I played basketball in college, and there was a summer league that we're in, and one of the people I played with was George Raveling, who later on became coach of Southern Cal and then Washington. Raveling in 63, Martin Luther King's famous speech in Washington. He was one of the security guards. He had volunteered for it and stood behind King to make sure, you know, if somebody wanted to shoot him or somebody wanted to get to him, that he would be part of a group that would protect him. King finishes the speech, leaves it on the lectern, and Raveling says to him, Dr. King, can I have that speech? And he handed him the speech. Today, it's in a safety deposit box worth millions of dollars.
Yeah, let me share my story on that. I was a young reporter in Washington, D.C., because I had started at the Washington Post. And when I got into the broadcasting side, I was standing on the left side of the Lincoln Memorial, right maybe 10 feet away from Martin Luther King when he gave that speech. And I'll never forget it because I looked over the people that were out there and it was a sea of people by the reflecting pond there. And every time I think about it, I get goosebumps. So it's interesting that you had the experience, or George Raveling had it, and I had that type of experience as well. Upton, in knowing you as long as I did, the one thing I always knew about you is that you loved what you did. I mean, we only have 3 minutes left, but you loved what you did. And you did a lot, and you were successful, even now with your broadcasting career and all the media things you're doing. What was the essence of your happiness as well as your success?
Well, I talk about it in the last chapter in the book. Actually, I'm just going to make it the whole football story and stories about America, but the Nebraska Press wanted me to do something on my radio and television career. And it's funny, 3 years in a row, my show was named the best show by the Associated Press. And I left sports to do just straight talk and interviewed people like Kissinger and Stephen Hawking and people like that. So I remember that night walking up the final night before my peers at the AP Awards and had been named for the third year in a row. And you know what I thought to myself, Ron? I said, this is one of the biggest moments you can have in your life. You know, you've been honored many times. And I said, you know what? I give it all up to go back to a team, not necessarily to run it, but there's something about a team to me that's a family. And all my family was gone when I was very, very young. And I said, it's funny, that's just the way I feel. I don't have to be a big deal. It's not important for me to say, geez, you're a great star. This, what was important to me was being part of something that was bigger than me. Kind of a funny feeling, but that's the way I feel about it.
In about 90 seconds, when you think back on your life and your career, is there one moment that's kind of etched into your mind that you will never forget, Upton?
I would say in the first chapter, my father's death. He died watching the two teams that he used to own on the field where he played in the last 2.5 minutes of the game, and I'm sitting across on the other side and saw a man slump down. I tried to run across the field to save him, and ironically, they brought up the oxygen from the Steelers bench and tried to work on the oxygen didn't work, and somebody yelled out, "Those GB Steelers, they're always screwing it. Even the oxygen doesn't work." So basically, he died that day. Red Smith said it was one of the great endings in history of sport. But on the other hand, we found out that week that he had made a secret deal to buy back the Philadelphia Eagles, the team he founded. And if he had lived another 3 days, we would be talking about me owning the Eagles instead of just owning underwear.
Upton, I want to thank you very much. It's been a long time since we've talked, but I'm going to make a habit of getting in touch with you more often. I want you to have come back with me and talk a little bit more about the history of the National Football League and your thoughts about it today and as we move forward. But your friendship, I said to you before we got on the air, you were a part of my development as to what I am today, and I can't thank you enough for it. It is one of the joyful times in my life and also in my career. And you are welcome here anytime on Sports Byline, my friend.
Ron, thank you. It's been my pleasure. Absolutely.
Upton Bell, former NFL executive, current talk show host and commentator, and check out his book. It's an excellent, excellent read. You're going to really love this. Present at the Creation, My Life in the NFL and the Rise of America's Game. We continue across the country and around the world. We've got you on America's sports talk show, Sports Byline.